The idea with part two is to become more aware of how your perceptions impact your thinking and or decision making. By having a clear idea of how you perceive things, you can move through the OODA loop process faster. A challenge people face during this stage is that everyone's view of things is influenced by their own life experiences and perceptions. You're also reorienting yourself all the time as new information comes to you via the observation phase. There are five influences that you need to be aware of during this phase of the loop. Cultural traditions, genetic heritage, the ability to analyze and synthesize information, previous experiences, new information. Part 3, decide. This stage is where the actual decision is made based on your observations and orientation. But any spy will tell you that as new information continues to pour in, your decision-making process can be impacted. Many things will run through your mind, from where you will go to how you will move, when will you move, who you need to avoid, and how to escape. As you learn to move through the cycle, you'll start to see that all the information from part one is filtered through the orientation phase, where your perceptions ultimately help influence the decision you end up making. Part four, act. This is where your decision becomes action. However, it is important to note that the action actually starts the loop all over again. Now you must observe how the action you've taken has changed the situation. You must observe again, orient, decide, and ultimately act based on how the situation is now playing out. It sounds complicated, especially when we're talking about making life-altering decisions in a matter of seconds. But if you start to practice this cycle, you'll see how your mind starts to funnel through this process almost effortlessly. Becoming aware of how you process information can have a huge impact on outcomes, whether you're dealing with a big business decision or an imminent threat. Tactic number two, traveling in the age of terrorism. We've all woken up, turned on the news, and discovered that many lives have been lost in another tragedy such as the terrorist attacks that have taken place in France, Belgium, Turkey, and Germany. Travel has never been more complicated, and at times, the idea of leaving home can seem overwhelming or even frightening. It can be tempting to avoid travel, whether it's for business or pleasure. But I believe in empowering yourself so that you can travel with confidence. Intelligence officers are well-prepared travelers, and that's been true long before terrorism became one of the biggest concerns on every American's mind. This is how spies do it. Build relationships everywhere you go. Oscar started building a relationship with Ezra the second he arrived at the conference. Obviously, at that time, he had no idea that later that day he'd be asking Ezra to call the police and get potential kidnappers' cars towed. But that's why spies are always building relationships. Yes, part of that relationship building might be related to looking for new sources of information. But it doesn't stop there. Spies will make relationships everywhere they travel because they never know when one of those casual relationships will end up saving their lives. Spy encounters while traveling. Max, a near mugging. I was on an assignment in Paris. I was actually just enjoying a regular dinner out on the town with a friend. I wasn't taking a personal meeting or dining with a potential agent. When I arrived at the restaurant, I was greeted by the maitre d'. I did my best to say hello in French and tell him I was looking forward to our dinner. I was kind to everyone, from the busboy to the waiter. I asked lots of questions, but in a friendly way. I also complimented them on the food, which was incredible. My buddy and I were full after we finished our entrees, so we asked for the check and were planning to leave. One of the busboys came over after we asked for the check. He seemed nervous and he actually told us to stay put and suggested we have some dessert. I protested at first, but there was something about the way he was talking to us that made me think we should just stay. We ended up having dessert and another drink. On my way out, I discreetly asked the busboy, "Why did you want us to stay?" His English wasn't great, but I got the gist of what he was saying. This area is popular for muggers. They pay some of us to let them know when Americans are leaving the restaurant. I didn't want you to get mugged. I thanked him, grateful that I'd listened and glad once again that I'd been kind to a person who had the ability to keep me out of harm's way. Sam, a near bombing. I will never forget the time the concierge at the hotel I was staying at suggested I don't go out one night. I'd been going out nightly to Kansas City I was working in. I found the people at the front desk of a hotel in a foreign country really have their ear to the ground about what's going on, so I'm always especially nice to them. I tip heavily and always greet them warmly as I come and go from the hotel. The night he told me to stay in, terrorist bombed a disco frequented by Americans. I can't say that's where I would have been headed, but I appreciated him making the effort to keep me out of harm's way. As you can see, developing a good rapport with different people when you travel can help ensure your safety, or at the very least, make your trip more pleasant. Making a connection with everyone from the concierge and the maid to the waiters and shopkeepers can make a huge difference if you are overseas during an emergency. You never know when they might tip you off or provide essential information about what to do if there is an emergency. Be sure to follow these additional spy tips to stay safe when traveling. Support the local economy. That means frequent the same places locals use. Don't stay at a hotel that's full of Americans and don't eat at touristy restaurants. The truth is, generally speaking, terrorists are less likely to blow up their own people. Go deep into the culture. This is part of casing out a foreign city. Make a connection with the people providing your services. Thank them when appropriate and make conversation about family and children. Tell them how you are enjoying your stay in their country. Research customs before you travel. Do people shake hands or is touching considered inappropriate? Is looking people in the eye important or offensive? Your efforts will always be appreciated and they might just keep you safe. Practice what intelligence officers call the custom-made smile. During an introduction, when the other person says their name, say it back to them while giving them a big but sincere smile. Subconsciously, this makes a positive impact on the person you are meeting and fosters an immediate sense of trust. When you should avoid American embassies. I recommend finding out where the U.S. Embassy or consulate is located before you travel outside the United States. Unexpected things may happen. Passports get lost or stolen, or someone becomes seriously ill. And the embassy can be a big help. However, there are times when you should avoid the embassy. If you are abroad and a major terrorist attack happens, especially one that is perpetrated against Westerners, I would not recommend going to the embassy. If Westerners are the target, it's entirely possible the area immediately around certain embassies will become dangerous. In that case, I would recommend staying in areas that are less likely to be populated by Westerners until the immediate crisis is over. Spy travel essentials. In Spy Secrets That Can Save Your Life, I discuss some basic travel safety rules, such as which seats you should never book on a plane and how to stay safe in a taxi. Now I'm going to share some higher-level safety tactics that intelligence officers always follow. It is my hope that you won't let fear stop you from traveling for work or while taking your family on wonderful vacations. I do hope you'll make a point to be careful and will ensure the safety of yourself and your family by taking the following measures. The Travel Ready Kit. What to take with you? Unfortunately, terrorism is a major concern today. However, there are a few inexpensive items you can easily pack that might save your life. These items would also prove invaluable if you were ever caught in a big fire in a hotel. Number 1, flashlight. A simple item that you might not think to take on a vacation. If the lights go out during a fire or while you're in a crowded train station, you'll be able to see where you are going and where the exits are located. This can mean the difference between life and death. To get a free flashlight, the flashlight I take with me when I travel, visit www.spyflashlight.com. Number 2, a P100 mask. In the event of a chemical attack, this mask can actually filter out much of the harmful chemicals as well as ash, dust, and other toxins that will be floating around in the air. These masks can be found for under $10. I recommend getting the ones that have an air vent. If you are running, not having a vent may encumber your breathing and make it harder for you to get away. Have a mask for each member of your family. Number 3. Safety goggles. In a major disaster, such as when the Twin Towers fell on 9/11, the smoke and dust are so thick that people are forced to close their eyes while making their escape. Keeping a simple pair of safety goggles handy will enable you to keep your eyes open, making it easier for you to escape to safety. Number 4. A rigger's belt, paracord about 25 feet, and a carabiner. A rigger's belt looks much like an ordinary belt. The only difference is it can hold 5,000 pounds. You could use this belt and your paracord to lower your family members to safety in the event of a fire or explosion. Paracord can also be used to tie your children's hands to yours, connecting them to you should you have to escape. Number 5. Cheap, brightly colored rain ponchos. Not only will these be handy if it's pouring rain while you're traveling, but a bright yellow or bright orange rain poncho can be an excellent way to keep track of your family in an emergency. You can all identify each other by the bright color, making it easier to stick together or locate one another if you are separated. Number 6. A multi-tool. Useful for cutting something open, cutting paracord, and much more. And number 7. Antibiotics. I believe you should take a supply of antibiotics with you. In the event of an extreme emergency situation, it may be impossible to get access to this infection-fighting medicine. Favorite spy tool, the best hotel hiding places. I certainly hope you would never hide your cash or other valuables under the hotel mattress or in the toilet tank. That's the first place a criminal is going to look. If you absolutely have to hide something in your hotel room, there are two places I recommend. First, the bathtub spout. Simply stick the item you want to hide up the bathtub spout and then pack it with toilet paper so it doesn't fall out. If you do this, be sure to use the Do Not Disturb sign on your door so that housekeeping doesn't stumble upon your stash while cleaning. Second, the shower curtain rod. This takes a bit more time and energy, but it's a good hiding place. Use your multi-tool to pry off one of the ends of the curtain rod and stash your cash or valuables in the tube. To see more places you can hide your valuables in hotels and in your own home, be sure to visit www.survivelikeaspy.com for a free training video I put together for you. Spy Encounters, Cormac. Penetrating the Circle. Sometimes there are groups you just can't break into no matter what. In these situations, you have to find someone who is so appealing to whoever your target is that they won't be able to resist. They'll let the guy into their circle, thinking they've won a great prize. But in reality, this person is collecting secrets and sending them back to you. This is a situation I've seen many times over the course of my career. Take Iran, for example. You just can't approach an Iranian professor or researcher hoping you'll be able to work him and eventually get him to tell you secrets about the nuclear program. It's impossible. In a situation like that, you have to use a penetration agent. It's the same process of spotting, assessing, and developing, but the only difference is that in this case, you're finding someone else who can penetrate the circle. I had 6 different aliases, and I might come off as a friendly Scot at a state dinner to someone I started a dossier on. I'm interested in this guy because he's hanging out with people who have access to information we want. He doesn't have the information, but he associates with people who do. I might start talking to him about how our countries need to know each other better, maybe keeping the talk on just economics. I wouldn't bring up anything nuclear. I'd get him comfortable discussing his political views. I find something he can easily get for me. It's like a side job. He gets me something, and I get him a bit of money. Away down the line, once he's used to the clandestine nature of the relationship, the requirements start getting harder, but he gets more in return. Eventually, he's a full-fledged agent. He's penetrated the circle for me, getting info from people I can't get to. He's not giving me secrets of his own, but the secrets of his associates, friends, or coworkers. Chapter 8. Turning a Soldier into a Spy. How a first-time case officer taught a decorated war hero to do brush passes, dead drops, and signaling to help the United States. The requirement. Find individual to transplant into hostile territory in North Vietnam. Once this individual is settled in the North, assist them in establishing a clandestine operation that will enable them to organize, collect, and communicate intelligence to U.S. intelligence officers. Participants. Case Officer Henry Frazier, hereafter referred to as alias Cormac. Trong Nhu, hereafter referred to as alias Rex. My first agent. Cormac recalls, I've never forgotten Rex. He was the first agent I had ever worked with as a case officer, and it proved to be a very challenging operation. Rex was a highly decorated war hero who had been wounded several times in battle. But even more extraordinary than that, he was willing to do something really big for the U.S. government. Another case officer had found Rex, and before handing him off to me, he discovered Rex was willing to defect. What that really meant was that he was going to let us make him disappear. He'd get taken out of Cambodia by a body smuggler, only to eventually pop up at the North Vietnamese embassy saying he wanted to defect. A war hero from the other side would be impossible to resist. Someone like Rex, who was in the military, would have lots of information and valuable secrets. It seemed very likely that they'd allow him to defect. Once Rex got settled, we'd set him up with everything he needed to funnel secrets back to us. That was the plan, anyway. A crooked body smuggler. Unfortunately for Rex, the first time we tried to make him disappear was a complete disaster. We had to make everything look as real as possible, so that meant Rex had to be taken out of the country by a real smuggler. The U.S. government couldn't get him out with someone pretending to be a smuggler. If they got caught, or the Vietnamese government decided to do some digging, they needed to immediately discover that this smuggler was a really bad guy. The situation needed to look legitimate. So Rex worked the black market to find a body smuggler to take him out of South Vietnam and across the border into Cambodia. Rex's next move after that would be to go into North Vietnam, approach the embassy, and ask for asylum. The whole thing was a mess. The body smuggler took his money and deserted him and left him alone in the jungle with nothing. Rex was tough and incredibly determined, though. He managed to walk all the way right back through the jungle. He communicated to his case officer shortly after he got back that he hadn't made it. At that point, the United States decided it would be a good idea to give Rex some extra training before he attempted to defect again, and that's when he was handed over to me. Training Rex. Date, time, and place of contact. Safe house, in April, location still classified. Name, Rex. Age, 26. Height, 5'5". Weight, 152 pounds. Hair, short, military style. Glasses, no. Personality, demeanor, attributes. Highly adaptive, skilled, quick thinking, shows dedication and determination. Has undergone discrimination and shows great interest in helping U.S. interests. Wounded several times, recovered well. Nationality, citizenship. Vietnamese, Chinese, Vietnamese. Known languages. Vietnamese, Chinese, English. Family. Mother, age 51, father, age 55, brother, age 16, brother, age 15. Address, Army Barracks. Rex and I were set up in a safe house together, and the idea was that I'd spend the next 3 months training him. We'd work on some basic tradecraft, as well as encryption and decryption skills. One of the most important jobs a case officer has is to protect his assets, so we take the training of agents very seriously. Until you actually do it, many people can't conceptualize a brush pass, a dead drop, or how to use signals or a concealment device. These moves might sound easy, but then you see someone try to execute them, and it's a big mess. You have to work closely with an agent and figure out what works best when it comes to communicating and passing information along to that person. Training Rex went well. He was smart and eager, but I faced some unusual challenges that had nothing to do with the tradecraft training itself. Rex was supposed to stay in the safe house completely out of sight. Obviously, we didn't want him to be seen with me. But apparently, being cooped up all the time was too much for him, because eventually, I realized that he was slipping out and even managing to find girlfriends. This made me really nervous for obvious reasons. It was my first case, and I didn't want to screw up, but I figured I couldn't really keep this guy a prisoner for the next 3 months. I ended up agreeing to drive him around. I even dropped him off places and took him out for dinner once in a while. I thought his chances of not being caught might be better if I stuck around to keep an eye on him. He was always wearing civilian clothes, so that helped. I also made sure to take him out only after dark and to choose places I thought we would be relatively safe. Luckily, we never got caught. What is a safe house really like? There are many different kinds of safe houses all over the world. They range from a random, generic hotel room used as a temporary safe house to a regular suburban home. Some safe houses have what is known as a safe house keeper. This would be an ordinary civilian with a highly unusual job. It might be a young man, a bachelor, who goes off to work every day like most people, but he has a very interesting side job. He's also keeping the house stocked and prepared for any operatives who may need to come in and out. He may also pick up operatives from the airport. Chances are the neighbors wouldn't even notice. It would appear that he's a regular person who occasionally has overnight guests. Sometimes, especially in war zones, military bases are used as temporary safe houses. Some operatives carry an ID that allows them on any U.S. military base in the world. However, most intelligence officers will tell you that you should never bring a sensitive asset on an American base because you can't let them be seen. The asset must remain a secret even from other individuals on a base. In certain parts of the world, that could cause problems, like the individual being executed. When dealing with a sensitive asset, it's better to transfer them to a warehouse or another safe site. The wrong guy and learning a big lesson. Cormac continues. I had a really embarrassing incident one night when I was picking up Rex. It was such a rookie mistake, but I also learned how important it is to be careful when picking up your agent, or the guy you think is your agent. I wanted Rex to blend in, so he purposely dressed like everyone else around him. It was a poor, more rural area, so he wore simple clothes. Unfortunately for me, Rex might have blended in a little too well. I was driving my car down a quiet dirt road in the early evening. I'd arranged with Rex previously that I'd pick him up along the road at a certain time. I could see Rex a couple of hundred yards ahead of me. He was wearing short pants, a button-down shirt, and thongs. I slowed the car down, and Rex didn't turn around. I assumed he knew it was me in the car. What I usually did was slow the car way down, and Rex would quickly hop into the back seat. We had done this many times before, and I barely even had to stop. Rex got in, and I started talking to him. He didn't say anything back, which was unusual. I turned around and immediately realized I'd made a huge mistake. I didn't pick up Rex, I picked up a completely different person. Just as I was realizing my mistake, this guy was seeing he'd made a mistake too. It immediately became obvious to me that he was an agent too, just as he was seeing that I wasn't his case officer. He got out of the car and I drove off to find Rex, which I eventually did. I had no choice but to look at the bright side. I might have messed up, but now I knew the person I picked up was working for someone else and not necessarily for the U.S. government. I'd have to keep my eye out for him from now on. Think like a spy. Be prepared to be flexible when it really matters. Obviously, it would have been bad if Rex responded. However, it was clear to Cormac that, while Rex was an excellent agent and was picking up what he was being taught very quickly, the problem with this guy was that he wasn't going to stay put. Rex had no interest in staying inside a house for 3 months. Rather than force the issue, Cormac decided that he would try to control the situation to the best of his ability by taking Rex out himself. It might not have been ideal, but he could manage where and when Rex was going out. Had Cormac instead insisted on strictly enforcing the rules, Rex probably would have gone out anyway, but on his own, he was much more likely to get caught, which would have ruined their operation. Don't sabotage the situation because you refuse to be flexible. Clandestine communications. Cormac continues. Rex was an excellent student and learned quickly. The first thing I trained him to do was to use the micro dot reader, which was a small piece of plexiglass about half an inch long that works much like a magnifying glass. A micro dot camera would capture the text of the message we wanted to send and shrink it all down to something approximately the size of a period. Any regular looking piece of correspondence could actually contain a secret message in the form of a micro dot, legible only to those with access to a reader. We also worked with the one-time pad, or OTP, which is another means of using a secret code to communicate. Both the agent and the case officer would get a copy of the OTP, with one person taking the pad for encoding, the other the pad for decoding. The text is paired with secret random keys that are listed in 5-digit groupings. Sheets from one-time pads were never used twice, hence the name, making them nearly impossible to crack. After a sheet was used, it would be destroyed. Once Rex mastered these different means of covert communication, I taught him how to use a one-way voice link, or OWVL. This meant that he could tune in to a certain frequency on the shortwave radio and wait to hear a specific 5-digit number that was meant as a signal to him. Following his signal code would be the real message Rex needed to hear, encrypted, of course. He would then write down the numbers and decode the message using a miniaturized codebook. Smuggling Rex and the equipment. Date, time, and place of contact. Safe house, the month of August, location still classified. When we felt that Rex was ready to try being smuggled over the border again, we realized we had an additional obstacle to tackle. Now that Rex was trained in covert communication skills, we wanted him to have access to a microdot reader, codebooks, and a shortwave radio. Obviously, Rex couldn't be smuggled into a hostile country carrying any of those things. He wouldn't have anything other than the clothes on his back and some food. All of his supplies would have to be brought to him covertly. And this is where our problem came in. We could find a way to get the stuff he needed across the border covertly, but we would need a way to communicate to Rex that the items were ready to be picked up. After much planning and some genius work by the technical team, we were able to provide Rex with a simple pair of thongs that had a secret compartment. It was just big enough to hold a microdot reader and a miniature codebook. Now we had a way to keep in touch with Rex and to tell him when the other supplies he needed were ready to be picked up. A snafu that cost us everything. Rex was told to contact a smuggler again, and we all prayed that this time it would go as it should. This time the plan was for Rex to be smuggled into Phnom Penh, the capital of Cambodia. Once he got there, he would find the Hong Kong accommodation address. A dead drop had also been loaded with some crucial items, some much-needed cash, and the first message that he would decipher with his microdot reader. After Rex disappeared, it took quite some time for him to be listed as a deserter. When it finally happened, this news proved incredibly difficult for his family. They knew nothing about what Rex was doing, and it was shameful to them that he was a deserter. I was waiting anxiously for a communication. I was in a difficult position because North Vietnam was a denied area for the United States. We had no embassy in North Vietnam nor any secure facilities. The only help we would have was from an asset in the Hong Kong office. I breathed a big sigh of relief when we received word that Rex had made it across safely. Rex arrived intact even though he was once again robbed by the smugglers. After decrypting his first microdot message, he knew that he was supposed to head to a library in Phnom Penh. There was a dead drop waiting for him, hidden carefully below a shelf of books in the history section. He let us know he had unloaded the dead drop and received a package by inserting a thumbtack on the wall near the bathroom for our asset to see. It seemed like everything was off to a great start. The next order of business was for Rex to purchase a shortwave radio so that we could continue communicating with him. He did this and transmitted a message saying that he was safe and was going to scout out the North Vietnamese embassy tomorrow. The next day, Rex arrived at the embassy. He was received by a senior army captain and explained that he wanted to defect. Rex was interrogated for 2 harrowing hours and eventually told to come back in 2 weeks after they conducted an investigation. 2 weeks were going to feel like a long time, but I was confident that Rex's story would check out fine. Rex was a decorated war hero, and that was documented in newspapers. His story could easily be checked out and verified. We all anxiously waited out the next couple of weeks until Rex's next appointment at the embassy. When he got there, Rex was told they were not yet finished conducting the investigation. This, of course, started to make everyone nervous. It was clear that Rex was being strung along, and I didn't want him to end up in jail. I was frantically trying to get my chief of operations to do something, but I was left frustrated. I was even told spending a night or two in jail would be good for his story. I wasn't getting anywhere, and I was worried for Rex's safety. Unfortunately, the situation got even worse. I soon received a message that said something to this effect. Where are you? Why are you ignoring me? Why have you deserted me? I need money, and this is a very bad situation. I'm going to sell my radio, microdot reader, and OTPS. I have no choice. Please respond. The captain in North Vietnam continued to drag out the situation, and there was nothing I could do. It soon became clear that there was a snafu, and it was causing a serious problem. I had been sending Rex covert messages via the shortwave radio, but it was obvious he wasn't receiving them. It soon became clear that Rex had confused the time difference and was listening for our signals at the wrong time. Rex was patiently listening to the radio, hoping to hear the signal and receive a message from us, but he was never going to hear our message and any further communication was impossible. His last message stated something along the lines of that he was going to try to make it to the Viet Cong on his own, but he never made it. Shortly after we received this communication from Rex, there were massive B-52 strikes along the Ho Chi Minh Trail. We had to assume that Rex was killed. The story ended tragically. A year later, he was presumed dead. There was no way he could have survived. His family never knew what he did, even though a courier brought them $10,000 in cash. They never knew what happened to him or about the heroic actions he took. He died with his family thinking he had defected. Think like a spy. Pay attention to every detail. In this case, a major mistake was made that could have been easily avoided, and the consequences were deadly. Unfortunately, it's not uncommon for people to make plans, only to have them messed up when we fail to take into account a simple but crucial detail like a time difference. Double-check details when making plans to avoid mistakes that can cost you frustration, time, money, or your life. Your inner spy. Technology has obviously changed dramatically since the days of the Cold War, providing intelligence officers with newer and more sophisticated ways of gathering intelligence. However, any spy will tell you that no technology can beat the information you can collect with clandestine humint, aka tradecraft. This means that intelligence officers still have to be highly skilled at tradecraft. Passing off and receiving actual information from other people still is and will always be a critical part of an intelligence officer's job. These tactics aren't difficult to master with practice, they're fun too, and we practice these skills and many others at our Ultimate Spy Week, www.ultimatespyweek.com. Tactic number one, clandestine human operational techniques. Brush passes. When a spy needs to physically pass an item to another operative, they'll do a brush pass. When it's done right, no one will see that a physical item has changed hands. Onlookers will just see you brush past each other in a casual way without noticing that you've actually swapped identical-looking items. Chances are you're not going to be in a situation where you have to slip something to someone without being detected, but brush passes are fun to do and easy to practice. To do it successfully, it's best to be in a crowded area where people walking around will make it hard for you to be seen passing the object. You would predetermine with the other operative what kind of object you'll both be holding. They need to appear identical. You could use a magazine, a newspaper, a briefcase, or even an umbrella. You would store the note or object you want the other person to get within the item that's being passed. Once the operatives have spotted each other, they'd quickly exchange items. As they each walk their own way, it looks like they still have the original item in their hands. Dead drops and concealment devices. When a case officer like Cormac needs to get information or supplies to an agent like Rex, they'll do a dead drop. A dead drop is a standard way of passing something along to another person covertly. While a simple object like a newspaper works perfectly for a brush pass, a concealment device is needed for a dead drop. Throughout history, some surprising and clever items have been used as concealment devices. Secret messages have been encased in wine corks and coins. Information has been stuffed into teeth, and believe it or not, at one time it wasn't uncommon to use dead animals as concealment devices. Once intelligence officers figured out that dousing the dead animal with a bit of hot sauce kept other animals away, secret items were stuffed into the carcass and then sewn up. While such objects are interesting, you'll be relieved to know that something as simple as a small box will work just fine. Just keep the following in mind when preparing a concealment device for a dead drop. Number one, while your object needs to be identifiable by the person who is picking it up, you also want to make sure it blends in with the environment. Don't use something that's odd or interesting enough that someone else will be tempted to pick it up. Number two, while you are hiding your concealment device, remember that while you are hiding it in plain sight, your agent needs to be able to locate it without arousing suspicion. While it shouldn't be visible from the street, you also don't want to hide it so well that the other person will be digging around for a long period of time. That will draw attention to the situation. Number three, know the culture of the area and how it might impact your dead drop. If you're in an area where streets are cleaned regularly, think carefully about where you are placing your item. Spies who have worked extensively in Japan know that it is an incredibly clean place. Any concealment device disguised as trash would likely be picked up. Dead drops. Don't make these mistakes. Don't look back. You should know that this is one rookie mistake that can really mess up your dead drop. Once you've made the dead drop, keep moving forward and do not look back. It's human nature to want to leave the item and then turn around to see if anyone is watching you. However, that move is a dead giveaway that you're up to no good, and ultimately you're drawing attention to the item you're leaving behind. Don't make it too good. Ron needed to pass along some information to another operative. He enclosed the information in a plastic bag and placed it under a rock near a predetermined location by a river. A few days went by, and it became clear that the individual who was supposed to unload the dead drop never did it. Ron went back to the location to see what happened, and that's when he realized he'd made a big mistake. It turns out it had rained, and there was mud everywhere, lots of puddles, and all of the rocks had shifted. Even he couldn't find the rock where he left the dead drop. Ron learned how badly weather can mess up a dead drop, and he was sure never to make that mistake again. Favorite spy tool, the corncob concealment device. Believe it or not, my favorite spy tool was inspired by a memory of going to state fairs when I was young. People would get corn on the cob, eat it, and sometimes wouldn't bother to throw the cobs in the garbage. They just tossed them on the ground. Many years later, when I was working as an intelligence officer in a foreign country, I was walking down the street and I actually encountered a tortoise nibbling on a discarded corn cob. He ate it much like a person would, eating any of the corn that was left but not eating the cob itself. I realized that in the country I was currently in, much like back at the state fair, people would throw corn cobs on the ground and it wasn't unusual to see one. I started to think this would make the perfect concealment device. It wouldn't seem unusual and no one would want to touch it. If an agent knew where to look, he could easily pick it up and access the secret materials inside. It became my favorite concealment device of all time. Of course, there were parts of the world where my corn cob wouldn't work as well. It wouldn't fit in with the environment. In those cases, I've used things like empty energy drink containers, cigarette packages, false bricks, and even emptied out chapstick tubes. It's funny. I've really developed a habit. I can't even walk through a parking lot without looking at a stray piece of trash and wondering if that empty soda can is really holding secret information. Probably not, but I can't help it. It's just long years of training kicking in. Tactic number 2. Moving dead drops. The car toss. A car toss can be an excellent way to pass along information. It's kind of like a dead drop in motion. There are a few ways a car toss can be approached. One is for the person in the car to slow down, tossing an object outside of the window for the other person to retrieve. A colleague of mine loves to use a sock to stash the secret items he's going to toss. You can spin a sock, like you're about to throw a lasso, and toss it with some velocity if necessary. Conversely, an agent can toss something into a car as it's moving. Obviously, this has to be done with care, as you don't want it to be obvious that something is being thrown to or from the car. It's also possible to stick a concealment device on the car for the other person to retrieve later when the car is parked. It's also possible to throw an item while you're walking, which is called a foot toss. Just keep it simple and remain casual. After executing a car toss or foot toss, always conduct a surveillance detection route to make sure you aren't being followed. I've put together a special training video for you where you can see many dead drops in action. You can watch it for free at www.survivelikeaspy.com. Tactic number 3. I think I've seen him before. How to recognize people. Being able to recognize people in different environments is a very important skill for a spy to have, and it's also incredibly difficult to master, especially as we saw in Cormac's account of mistakenly picking up the wrong agent at a meeting point. Many intelligence officers will admit that recognizing faces is something they consistently struggle with and must continue to practice. We've all been in a situation at the store, your kid's school, or church, where someone approaches you in a friendly manner and says hello, and you have no idea who the person is. That's awkward, but at least it's not putting you in a dangerous situation. Being able to recognize people in your immediate environment can help you determine if you might be in danger from someone who is following you. One of the best ways to train your brain to recognize people is to practice. Number 1. Start noticing the people around you when you're out in public. Do they have any distinctive facial features? What does their hair look like? How tall are they, and what kind of build do they have? Number 2. What are they wearing? Are they carrying anything? As I said in Spy Secrets That Can Save Your Life, always notice the shoes. Often someone will shed a jacket, put on glasses or a hat, maybe even a wig, but they'll often neglect to change their shoes. So make a point of noticing if they're wearing boots or shoes, sneakers or loafers. Number 3. What kind of gait do they have? Do they have a long stride? Do they take short steps? Do they move their arms in a particular way when they walk? Number 4. Are they participating in any memorable behaviors? For example, are they smoking? If they are, try noticing what kind of cigarettes. Or maybe this person is smoking a pipe. Perhaps they are walking a dog. Note anything that might help you remember that person. And number 5, who does this person resemble? Sometimes it can help to associate a person with the celebrity they look like. Perhaps someone looks like Clint Eastwood or reminds you of Jack Nicholson. What about them causes you to note that resemblance? Once you've gotten in the habit of noticing such characteristics, challenge yourself. Pick a person you see out in public and describe him to yourself. Wait an hour or two and then write down the description. How much can you remember? Continue practicing until noticing a person's characteristics becomes second nature. You just might need it someday. Chapter 9. Giving a high-level ambassador a bugged painting. How to embed cameras and microphones when it's you who needs to spy on someone. The requirement. Find the means to collect intelligence from Vietnam's ambassador to France to aid the United States in ongoing peace talks. Participants: Case Officer Daniel Novak, hereafter referred to as alias Marcus. Access Agent Pierre Perdue, hereafter referred to as alias Monty. Target Don Bach, hereafter referred to as alias Vadim. Marcus recalls, "I met Monty not long after I arrived in France, and he had all the qualities a case officer looks for in an access agent. Monty was smart, charming, and highly educated, and he and his wife loved to entertain in their palatial apartment. Even better, Monty was incredibly well-connected and part of a very powerful social circle. Everyone loved to attend his cocktail parties because you never knew who you might run into. There were professors, artists, actresses, musicians, wealthy businessmen, and luckily for me, ambassadors and other high-level government people. When you're a case officer, you're always looking for someone who has access. And Monty had access to nearly everyone. It took a long time to develop him. Monty didn't need the money like other people I had worked with. Over time, though, I learned that Monty agreed with the United States on certain issues. It was that mutual philosophy that eventually got Monty working for me as an access agent. I also think he found the idea of spying very exciting, which most people do. I really enjoyed working with Monty because he was clever and quick. We tried some crazy things while we were working together, and let's just say some of them worked out better than others." The art-loving diplomat. Date, time, and place of contact. September 15th, 9 p.m., home of Monty, classified location. My requirement was to collect intelligence from a diplomat who represented the interests of the North Vietnamese government. Big peace talks were happening, and it was my job to get any information I could that would help the United States. I didn't always know exactly what my plan would be to fulfill a requirement, and this was one of those times. After months of watching the diplomat and the people who worked in his house, I'd come to the conclusion that I wasn't going to be able to get any of his staff to help me out. They were too loyal. I had to find another way in, and I never imagined that Monty would come up with a great idea at one of his infamous parties about how to bug an embassy. Monty had hosted a dinner party one night, and after dessert, guests were hanging around in the living room and on the veranda drinking wine and chatting. Monty realized he hadn't seen Vadim in a while. He wasn't with any of the groups in the living room or outside. Vadim was a diplomat from North Vietnam, and he was someone Monty paid much attention to. Getting information from Vadim could be the key to fulfilling our requirement, but we still hadn't figured out how to do it. Monty had picked up some good bits and pieces of information from cocktail chatter, but nothing that could really help the United States with the peace talks. We needed something much bigger. Monty saw that the door to his library was open and there was a light on. He walked in and found Vadim standing in front of the large painting that was hanging behind Monty's desk. Vadim was so transfixed by the work of art that he didn't even notice that Monty had entered the room. After a few moments went by, Monty said something so that Vadim wouldn't be surprised by his appearance. It's a beautiful piece of art, isn't it? My wife gave it to me as an anniversary gift, and it's one of my most cherished pieces. It was actually painted by an artist in the south of France. Monty was always a quick thinker. The truth was, it wasn't a gift at all. His wife was from an old French family, and this painting had been in her family for several generations. Much to his wife's chagrin, Monty didn't even like it all that much. But it was clear that Vadim did. They spent the next half an hour talking about the painting's various characteristics, the brushstrokes, and the artist's use of lighting. And that's when Monty got the idea that he should present Vadim with a gift. Beware of Greeks bearing gifts. We all know to beware of Greeks bearing gifts, and that things didn't end well for the Greeks after they accepted the gift of a wooden horse left outside of their city gates. They pulled the massive horse inside, only to later find out it was filled with Trojan warriors ready for a fight. While the gift Monty had in mind wasn't quite so dramatic, using a Trojan horse as a listening device is always very risky. Intelligence officers can use a Trojan horse in the form of a gift, but it's not something that can be taken lightly. The gift might appear to be just an ordinary sculpture, pen, or vase, but inside are listening devices so that every conversation that takes place can be recorded and listened to. The problem is that if the recipient discovers the bug, they knew exactly who is responsible. And obviously, that creates a really big mess. And in certain countries, it's enough to get someone killed. The Great Seal Bug. One of the most famous Trojan horses was given to U.S. Ambassador W. Averill Harriman in August 1945. The Vladimir Lenin All-Union Pioneer Organization, a kids' organization not unlike the Boy and Girl Scouts in America, gave the ambassador a hand-carved replica of the Great Seal of the United States as a gift. This gift was hung in the residence of the ambassador in a place that was absolutely perfect for picking up conversations. What no one knew was that the seal contained one of the first concealed listening devices. Inside the seal was a high-frequency radio bug that meant it didn't require an outside power source, but was activated by a radio signal from outside the building. In the 1950s, some British radio operators reported hearing a British attaché speaking while listening to Russian radio traffic, and that was deemed very suspicious. Even with this tip, no bug could be found inside the embassy. The device wasn't actually discovered until three ambassadors and many overheard conversations later. A painting with unique properties. Marcus continues. The gift that Monty had in mind was a painting. Since the ambassador loved the painting so much, we decided to have a replica created for him. However, this painting would have a little something extra, a covert listening device. We worked with Technical Services, who assigned one of their highly skilled artists to create a beautiful replica of Monty's painting. Nothing about the painting looked out of the ordinary. The canvas and the frame looked normal, and if you picked it up, it didn't seem unusually heavy. However, embedded inside the lining of the canvas were a microphone, a transmitter, and a battery powerful enough to run for 2 years. While we were excited to give this to the ambassador, we were also nervous. Anytime a Trojan horse is used in an operation, you have to carefully weigh the risks versus the rewards. If the listening device is discovered, Monty would be in big trouble. While he wouldn't be killed in the country we were working in, he would be exposed and would lose all his access. Treason was also a very big concern. We had decided early on that in this case, it was worth it. Monty had worked very hard to develop a relationship with Vadim, and Vadim had no reason to suspect that Monty would try to bug his house. He planned to give the gift as soon as it was ready. Think like a spy. Weigh your risks and rewards. There's no point in taking a risk just for risk's sake. Giving the ambassador a bugged painting was incredibly dangerous, and there could be major consequences. However, after the risk and the reward were carefully considered, it was decided that it was not very likely the bug would be found, and that the amount of intelligence that could be gathered was very great. Compare the risks to the rewards before going forward with decisions that could have unwelcome or even dire consequences. Hanging the painting. Date, time, and place of contact. October 12th, 7 p.m., home of Vadim, classified location. Marcus continues. Monty went to Vadim's beautiful townhouse to present him with the painting. Monty told him that he truly appreciated Vadim's friendship and was deeply moved by his appreciation for art. Vadim was, of course, delighted with the gift and accepted it graciously. What Vadim didn't know was that I was sitting in a car right outside with one of my colleagues. We were thrilled to discover that the listening device worked perfectly. We could hear everything they were saying as if we were in the exact same room. Vadim had some high-level people over for dinner that night, and we got a few good tidbits of intelligence. I couldn't believe how brilliantly the painting was going to work out. The next morning, I was back outside the ambassador's townhouse, eagerly listening for more information. The painting was still sitting in the foyer, not yet hung up. I heard Vadim ask one of his maids a few questions, and then I heard him speaking to another man. The nature of the conversation made it sound like he had a close friend or family member staying over. Whoever this guy was, he also loved the painting. In fact, he thought it was so wonderful that it should be hung in a place of great honor. Vadim immediately agreed. Those were the last words we heard from Vadim's house. He had decided that the place of honor was on a wall at the top of the stairs, a place where no one in the house ever seemed to have a conversation. I sat outside for a few weeks just to make sure, but it became clear we weren't going to hear any secrets from that beautiful painting after all. Think like a spy. You can't control everything. The biggest concern for Marcus and Monty was obviously getting caught. They didn't want Monty to get burned if someone found out they had bugged the ambassador's home. There was another concern, though, that the ambassador would choose to put the painting someplace where it wouldn't do anyone any good, and that's exactly what happened. Much time and effort is put into creating devices like Vadim's painting. Even though everyone involved knows it's entirely possible it won't work out in the end. Spies simply can't control every element of their environment. If you decide not to put effort into something just because it might not work, you might ultimately end up missing out on some good opportunities. It's often worth a shot. Favorite spy tool: the multiple plug adapter audio device. One of my favorite spy tools was a simple everyday device you'd use in any house when you just want to plug a few things into the same outlet. They are something everyone uses and no one has any reason to suspect they'd be anything but what they are. Except my multiple plug adapter contained a high-powered audio recording device. Like anything else, you can have a great success with one of these, or it can turn out to be a big flop. Once I had a guy infiltrate a film crew who was going to interview a very important figure at his home overseas. As he was setting up the audio equipment, he casually inserted the multi-plug into the outlet and purposefully left it behind. I was excited about what we were going to hear. We got some great information during the first few months, and it appeared to be a great success. But then all of a sudden, we heard nothing but loud static from time to time. It turned out that the maid had unplugged the vacuum, but she left the multi-plug attached to the cord of the vacuum cleaner. The potential for intelligence was so good that we kept listening for a while, but all we'd hear was the regular sound of a maid vacuuming. It was good while it lasted. Smuggling in a shortwave radio right under someone's nose. Participants: Case Officer Daniel Novak, hereafter referred to as alias Marcus. Agent Kwasia Carr, hereafter referred to as alias Lyndon. Marcus recalls, "I learned very quickly as a case officer that you had to get very creative when it comes to concealing audio devices. You always had to ask yourself, what might work? What can we conceal something in? After months of development, I had recruited a third country diplomat from Africa who was living in North Korea. We were putting him in as a press secretary, some kind of made-up job that wouldn't fall under suspicion. But communicating with him was going to be difficult. Mail couldn't be used at all because we knew that everything would be read and censored. I needed to get him set up with a shortwave radio, but getting it to him would be nearly impossible. Security was incredibly tight, and anything this man would be bringing with him would be carefully inspected. The lumber shortage that sparked an idea. I started to notice that when various officials moved into the area, it was normal for all of their belongings to come packed in wooden crates.